Welcome to Amplified, the Hermes podcast channel where we discuss the key issues, challenges, and trends shaping the investment landscape. I'm Johan Murray, Head of Investment at Hermes. Today, I'm joined by Saker Nusseibeh, the Chief Executive of Hermes Investment Management, and Hans-Christoph Hurt, our Head of Hermes EOS. The world is at a tipping point. Responsible investment, ESG, and stewardship, once seen as the preserve of niche green investors, has now become mainstream. Challenging accepted investment fundamentals, as well as investors, asset owners, and companies to do better. Saker, there are still many skeptics out there who are not fully convinced that ESG integration and engagement can truly drive enhanced returns. And so what would you say to them?
I think I would say I'm not entirely sure I understand where the skepticism comes from. There are two ways that you think you can make money out of investing in companies. One way is simply to trade, buy and sell over short periods of time, shares as pieces of paper, almost without any relevance to the underlying valuation. Statistically, that's not a good way of making money, even if you might think you might make some money in the short term. The real way of making money is long term. And if you're going to be invested in the long term in a company, I fail to understand which of these four factors you wouldn't take on board. Let's take them one by one. Would you not want to invest your money in a business which is sustainable in a variety of ways? Sustainable in having a strong relationship with its suppliers. Sustainable in the way that it has a strong resonance with its consumers, having its finger on the pulse of commerce. Sustainable in the sense of having the social license to operate within its own community and within its own regulatory environment. Sustainable in the sense of actually a business case that makes sense over the next, not just 1 or 2 or 3 years, but 10 years. So S, if you like, is an integral part of fundamental long-term analysis. What about governance? Well, I don't understand how I could want to invest in any company in which I am not protected as a shareholder from whether it is a purposeful or inadvertent power grab by the C-suite, or indeed malfeasance by the C-suite. That is governance. And moreover, how can I not protect against risk in my portfolio if I'm not assured that there's governance within each company to mitigate against the risks of business? So that deals with risk. The E, which is the environment, people sometimes conflate with just talking about global warming. I mean, that's one part of it. But it's the whole essence of environmental issues that can affect profitability and can affect performance. If we want to use hedge language, we would say that's a fat tail risk. Who would not consider fat tail risk when they want to invest? And so put all together, this is just ESG is simply the old-fashioned way that we learned in the mid-80s to do fundamental long-term investment. Now, let's go on to engagement. So if I own a company for the long term, then surely I need to be fully engaged as an owner in that company. That's not micromanaging the business, but that's assuring myself that it has the right structures to protect me, that it understands the business issues, that I understand their business strategy. And that means building a long-term strategy and understanding it with them. And that is the essence of stewardship and engagement. And why is that any different from a very famous Midwestern investor who sits on the boards of his companies when he takes stakes that stay for a very long term? So I repeat, I can't understand. This is just old-fashioned investment that has been proven to bring value and for some reason has been forgotten over the last 10 years.
So Saker, we talk about this as our approach to providing holistic returns for investors. And what exactly does that mean? And are we, in fact, doing any better for those end investors?
So I think we are, because if you take a long-term view of how you're investing and you take a truly long-term horizon, and you take all of these aspects together, then you've done two things for your investors. Number one, actually, you have done your best to maximize their returns, because that is the best way to maximize by understanding the long-term fundamental values of the company and having a sustainable business. But the second thing it would have done is helped create a sustainable eco-environment, both within the community and also within the business itself, to survive for longer. And let us not forget that your average investor, through their portfolio, generally speaking, is the shareholder of particular companies, but is also, generally speaking, their client or customer, possibly part of the supply chain and possibly part of the workforce, and generally speaking, lives in an environment shaped by that company. So when we talk about holistic returns, we're talking about how the end output is enhanced because the output of the company is better, because it's a better sustainable business. Go back to the origins of the whole idea of free markets. The whole idea of free markets, it's not just it maximizes profit over short term, but actually builds a vibrant, growing economic ecosystem that benefits the whole of society. Otherwise, if it doesn't, how can they buy the goods that we produce and so on? And actually makes the maximum amount of returns for the risk put in for those who have put up the capital. To do that and to achieve this holistic return, you integrate ESG, you integrate stewardship, and you arrive at the answer.
Hans, Zucker's been talking about the power of engagement. How would you define the characteristics of effective value-creating stewardship?
In our experience, the key is really to focus on material issues, those issues that impact on a company's risks and returns, and ultimately the value of a company. Typically, these value drivers are things like the sales, margins, capital. Very similar to fundamental analysis. But it's also critical to recognize how so-called non-financial or sustainability factors can affect these value drivers and to consider their impact upon the wider society and the environment. If you want to focus on such material issues, you need to be able to identify and to address them.
How do you actually go about doing this then?
In our experience, this requires a number of things. So to begin with, it's not just you need more resource, but you need broader and deeper experience and skill sets. So for example, you would need some scientists in your teams to challenge companies effectively on their climate change preparedness or their use of plastics. Again, if you want to hold chairs and non-executive directors to account, then you need to have very senior staff as corporate non-executive director experience who can really challenge the non-executive directors at investee companies. Another point is that you need to go beyond off-the-rack ESG research and meetings with investor relations. So it's critical to have direct interactions with non-executive directors, with chairs, and sometimes do site visits. You get invaluable insights for investment decisions and stewardship from these interactions. Critical, again, is close collaboration between the investment and stewardship teams. Both need to work together. Both have different experience and skill sets, and together they can ensure this focus on the material issues. And last but not least, you need to adopt a market and company-specific approach. So you need to really understand the regulatory environment, what engagement techniques can you use to pursue an engagement agenda, and you need to understand the company's governance structure and the people. And sometimes it's as simple as speaking the local language to have engagement success. So in summing up, if you want to focus on material issues, you need to be able to identify and address them. This requires not just more resource, but broader and deeper experience and skill sets. This requires going beyond off-the-rack ESG research and meetings with IR. This requires close collaboration between investment and stewardship teams. And it also requires market and company-specific approach.
So pursuing that theme, Hans, could you provide an example of where being good was good business? And what were the key factors that drove the selection of that company and the engagement?
For stewardship purposes, we generally look at the size of the holdings in the company. We're looking at the materiality of the non-financial ESG sustainability topic. And we look at the feasibility of an engagement with a company. So let me give you an example. Hunhai Foxconn is a major Taiwanese company that manufactures parts for and assembles products for Apple and other electronics companies. This company has a workforce of more than 1 million in China. And 6-7 years ago, they had a series of suicides in their factories that actually resemble small cities. And these suicides were attributed to working conditions. Now, this was not just a human capital or societal issue, but also a serious business issue for the company. Why? Because customers and investors were very concerned about being connected with such a company in the headlines for factory suicides. There was a real risk of losing significant revenue and also access to capital. So what we did, we had an intensive engagement with Hunhai over a number of years, and we have seen meaningful improvements of working conditions, pay of employees, and also wider employee welfare over the years. So some real societal benefits for the employees. At the same time, the company actually addressed the concerns by customers and investors and thus ensured the continued business success. So this is a case that shows that being good can actually be really good business.
Saker, turning back to yourself, ESG, investing or sustainability is very much a flavor of the month, and with many investment management firms stating now that they integrate ESG and launching ESG funds, but are they in fact just simply greenwashing?
So that's a very good question. And I think the answer is in the framing of the question, if you think about it. So many firms have decided that there's a huge demand out there, particularly from millennials, for ESG integrated funds. Increasingly now we see in the United States a massive demand from the wealth officers for even impact funds, and they've decided they've got to have some of that. And so what they typically do is they say, well, look, we go and buy some information from some service provider, we look at our portfolio, we're aware that our fiduciary duty is to try to maximize returns, so that's what we're really doing. And then to satisfy this customer demand, we'll look at our portfolio and we'll tick boxes, or indeed, if we have an impact demand, we'll go and we'll superimpose impact parameters onto our portfolio. Both of these, I think, are box-ticking exercises. And both of these things, I think, go against the essence of fiduciary duty as I understand it in the United States. In the first instance, if you say you are doing ESG simply by looking at something and you're not integrating it, you're looking at collateral benefit, you're not just looking at investment for investment's sake, and it is simply skin deep. It's not true integration. Is that greenwashing? Yes, it probably is. The surprise bit is the other one, which is the impact one. If somebody gives you an impact fund, actually your fiduciary duty is to do just that. To simply say, here is how I do business and I'll just superimpose what I understand impact to be on top of it, shows again that you're not really integrating it into the essence of what you do. At Hermes, we have taken the view that what we do, in essence, is integrate ESG and integrate stewardship because we can show over the last 30 years it enhances returns for the client and ends up with a better ecosystem within the free market society that we live. We know that. More recently, we have taken our expertise in building non-ESG funds, funds dedicated for impact. And unlike others, we have built them from the bottom up precisely to do exactly what the client has asked. In both cases, I think this is the right approach. Box ticking, I think, might attract the clients, is borderline questionable legally, and is not the right way to do things.
So attractive financial returns require going further than either box ticking or simply using the numbers.
Absolutely right.
Thank you, Saker and Hans. It's been a real pleasure speaking with you both. Until next time, I'm Johan Murray, Head of Investment at Hermes Investment Management. Thank you for listening.
Thank you for listening to the Hermes podcast. If you found it interesting and would like to listen to more podcasts by Hermes, please visit our website, hermes-investment.com, and search for podcasts. These podcasts are for information purposes only, and the views, information, or opinions expressed therein are solely those of the individuals involved and do not necessarily represent those of Hermes Investment Management and its employees. Performance should not be relied upon as a basis for investment decisions. All the performance represented is historical. Past performance is not a reliable indicator of future results, and investors may not recover the full amount invested.